Thank you, Alan. About 6 years ago, you know, actually a few months before he died, a Nobel Prize winner wandered into my office. He sat down and proceeded to talk about science and ethics. He did this for about 2 hours, and in fact, most of it would boil down to something like this. Science, he said, is in a very interesting predicament these days. It has accelerated so much in so little time and has led to this glut of information. You know, it has progressed beyond our wildest dreams such that we can do amazing things, exciting things, and even frightening things. Of course, you know, he said this stuff in a much less verbose way. And the Nobel Prize winner, I should note, was Michael Smith. He was inventor of something known as DNA site-directed mutagenesis, which is an unfortunate mouthful that some view as the first step towards all this genetic modification brouhaha that you hear about. You should, however, also know that he was a very nice man. Nevertheless, you know, it got me thinking about fear and science in our world, and 6 years later, this is what I've come up with. We should be very, very careful. And if you're keeping track, that's incidentally about one word for each year. And I've also learned that perhaps the best way to be careful is to build upon different perspectives, to be aware of different angles, to participate in debate and dialogue, to actually be proactive to expending the effort to get informed, a notion that all of our partners here at Terry believe the project is very much based on. When I asked David to take part in this series, I made some offhand remark that it would be great for him to come out and maybe participate in a Yoda-like fashion. He jokingly and humbly responded that really the similarities between him and Yoda were just their appearances. But you know, I'm not so sure. In him, you have an award-winning scientist, an environmentalist, and broadcaster. He's well known to millions as the host of CBC's popular science television series, The Nature of Things. I mean, for heaven's sakes, he was in the top 10 greatest Canadians. He was number 5, actually. He is chair of the David Suzuki Foundation and author of more than 40 books, the latest of which is entitled David Suzuki, The Autobiography, which will be published in the upcoming weeks. I guess my point is this. He is, by all counts, an individual with an inordinate amount of perspective, and it would do us well to listen very, very carefully. Please welcome David Suzuki.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for that generous introduction. I'd like to begin just by congratulating Alan and David. I've been away from the university a long time now, and it's just an absolute thrill to see your attempt to bridge across and get the discussion going between these two disparate groups. The most powerful force shaping our lives today is not politics, it's not economics, it's not sports or celebrity, it's science. Science when applied by industry, medicine, and the military. And one of the things I've decried at this university was that tremendous gap, the schism between the sciences and the arts. You know, here we are living in a world that was undreamed of when I was growing up as a child. When I was growing up in Vancouver in the 1930s, and then in Ontario after that, I wasn't allowed to go swimming in public pools or to movies in the summer because my parents were afraid I would catch polio. Polio, for most people, is not even something you think about, but it was a terrifying, dreaded disease back when I was a child. When I was a child, hundreds of thousands of people died every year of smallpox. Smallpox has been extinct now for over 2 decades. When I was a child, there were no jet planes. There were no transoceanic phone calls. There were no birth control pills, no plastics, no VCRs there was no television when I was a child. The world is a fundamentally different place, and yet today our media act as if arts and science are separate. They have nothing to communicate to each other, and if you look at our media, we're overwhelmed with politics and economics, celebrity and sports. So this is a small part, but a very important part of what I think is an attempt to redress the chasm that exists. We've got to be talking to each other and sharing perspectives. So congratulations, Alan and David, for pushing this series through. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share a few of my ideas. You know, I keep telling children, I'm just an old fart now. Next week, I hit my 70th birthday, so, you know, we are what we call geezers. And so to have an opportunity to share a few ideas is a great privilege for me. For over a quarter of a century, I lived, ate, and dreamed about genetics. It was the dominant activity of my life, and I'm very, very proud of the students and associates that I had over the years who passed through my lab and the extraordinary work that they did. I'm very proud of the contribution our lab made. And I've watched with astonishment at the incredible development of insights and the manipulative power that we've acquired in this area. This is surely in the area of molecular biology, what is now called biotechnology, is one of the most revolutionary and exciting activities in the very history of science. And I continue, as an old professor emeritus, to take great delight, vicarious delight, in the progress that is occurring in this area. And it is because the insights and the technology of molecular biology have become so powerful and revolutionary that I believe that we have to spend much more time thinking not beyond the marvelous opportunities and experiments and feats that we can dream up, and take much more time putting this work into a broader context. And I fear that my colleagues are simply not doing that. I was telling Alan and David in the wings here that 2 weeks before the infamous Oklahoma City bomber blew up the building, I chaired an all-day meeting of geneticists talking about the exciting advances that were going on in their area. And the main feature speaker was Jim Watson of Watson and Crick fame. And I did a fawning introduction to Watson, you know, how great it was to have a living scientist whose name is in every textbook right from K through university, blah, blah, blah. And he gave us a Jim Watson speech. And at the end, I called for questions, and people were pretty intimidated, and there were no questions. So I thought I better jump in, and I said, well, Professor Watson, what do you feel about the social responsibility of people involved in this area? And to my astonishment, he turned on me and said, I know what people like you think. You don't want any difference between people. You want everybody to be the same, which is a ludicrous kind of putting words into my mouth, which of course he had then proceeded to stomp on. And I was just horrified because as a chair, I couldn't rebut him at that point. And as soon as he was finished, he left. So I never got a chance to talk to him, but what shocked me was the absolute unwillingness to even discuss what I thought was a very simple and innocuous question. Now I know, of course, Jim was just being Jim, which is a total asshole. And it doesn't matter whether, just because you get a Nobel Prize, doesn't mean you can't be as big an asshole as anybody else in the world. Biotechnology executives, certainly in companies in this city, do not like people like me, even though they often are not geneticists themselves or even scientists, and they often do all they can to disparage those who might have questions or criticisms to make. So I'm delighted to have a chance in a blue ribbon audience like this to present my case. I'd like to begin by telling you that I am a third generation Canadian. I was born in Vancouver. And in 1942, my Canadian-born parents, my siblings, and I were deprived of all rights of citizenship, incarcerated for 3 years in the Rocky Mountains, and then expelled from British Columbia. Our crime, for which we lost all rights of citizenship, was the possession of genes that came from Japan 3 generations before. And Japan, after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese in Canada then were treated as enemy aliens. 22,000 Canadians of Japanese extraction were denied all rights of citizenship under the War Measures Act and sent away from the West Coast. What was the rationale for that act? The only rationale that makes any sense, of course, was racism. Racism, the belief that certain behavioral traits, in this case, treachery and deception, are hereditary traits. Pearl Harbor, our incarceration and expulsion, shaped my life for me as an individual. They created my hang-ups and my drives. They instilled in me a sickness, which I still haven't been able to get rid of, which is a need to prove to Canadians that I'm a worthwhile person, worthy of full Canadian citizenship. We were impoverished after the Second World War because British Columbia had kicked us out of the province. We had nothing, and we arrived in southern Ontario in 1945. My dad fortunately taught me, you've got to work 10 times harder if you're going to compete with white people. And so that working has always been one of the basic drives of my life. And to us, education was the key to escaping our poverty. When I was a kid growing up, if my father wanted to scare me, he didn't say, I'm going to whip your ass. He said, I'm going to pull you out of school and put you to work. That, to me, man, whatever I was doing that made him mad, I stopped doing it immediately, because education was the absolute key to our lives in those times. And I was very fortunate in 1954 to receive a scholarship to go to an outstanding college in the United States, Amherst College in Massachusetts. At that time, Amherst College valued international students. They felt that international students were a part of the education of those Americans who went to that college. Not the way that we're doing it now, which is we're looking at foreign students as an opportunity, bilking them of their money to raise more money for our universities. I'm ashamed of a university that seems to think international students are just an opportunity to make money. They contribute to what is a university education, it seems to me. And I was fortunate to go to a college in the United States at that time that valued me as a foreign student. They gave me a huge scholarship, $1,500 a year. In 1954, $1,500 was more than my father made in a year. So it was an amazing opportunity. And at Amherst, I was an honors biology student, and I had to take a course in genetics, as all honors students did. And it was in that course, in my junior year, my third year at Amherst, that I fell madly in love with the subject of genetics. I never imagined the precision and the elegance of a science in the life sciences. And although I had been accepted to medical school at the University of Western Ontario in my hometown in London, I decided to turn it down and go on to graduate school in genetics. And my mother wept for months because her son had turned down the chance to become a medical doctor to study fruit flies. She just never figured that one out. After completing a PhD and a postdoc, again in the United States, I decided that I wanted to return to Canada. I had become very heavily involved in the civil rights movement in the United States. And while I had been incarcerated in Canada under the War Measures Act, I felt that Canada was a smaller nation, a nation that I might have a chance to make a contribution to. Canada, to me, was different from the United States. Not better, but different, and for me, preferable. To me, Canada meant Tommy Douglas and the NDP. It meant Quebec and the CBC and the National Film Board and Medicare. And I've never regretted coming back to this country. In 1962, I took my first job that I could get in Canada, which was in the genetics department at the University of Alberta. And as the lowest man on the totem pole, I had to teach a course that they assigned to me, and it was a group of ag students. Boy, was I pissed off. I didn't want to teach a group of Aggies, and yet that class of 13 students was the best class I ever had. They worked hard and they played hard, and I was still in my early 20s. It was great to be with such a group of kids, and I still keep in touch with many of them today. But those students were asking me questions about plant and animal breeding. I didn't have a clue. I hadn't been taught that, and I was supposed to have had a great education. They asked me about disease resistance in plants and in animals, and I had to read up on that. And I thank my students there for teaching me these areas. And that winter in Edmonton, it was 40 below for a month. And I felt no human being should live under those conditions. And a job came up at UBC, and I grabbed it. And I was very lucky to come here in 1963. But most of my students in my course were pre-meds. Biggest group of liars, cheaters, and stealers in the university. And it was in those classes that they started asking me questions about cloning, about genetic engineering, about hereditary diseases and genes and IQ. Again, things that I hadn't been prepared for in the education that I had received. And I thought that I'd received this sensational education, and I had to read up. So again, thanks to my pre-med students and their questions, I was educated in a whole nother area. And to my amazement and horror, as I began to read, the two great passions of my life, genetics and civil rights, intersected in a grotesque way. I discovered in my reading that it was geneticists in the early part of the 20th century who were so intoxicated with the incredible discoveries being made in the field that they really felt they had their hands on the levers of life, that through genetics they would eliminate the terrible hereditary conditions that had afflicted humankind since the beginning of time. Through genetics, we would improve the human stock. And those were the claims being made and led to the creation of a whole discipline called eugenics, the study of heredity in human beings. And eugenics was to be an applied field of genetics. It was to be applying the hereditary principles. We're discovering, studying fruit flies and petunia plants and chinchillas, and into creating, to eliminating many of the hereditary problems in human beings. So negative eugenics was a discouraging of people who were considered genetically inferior from reproducing. So you do that by inducements, or you mandate it, have hereditary sterilization problems, or you offer incentives to be sterilized. But guess what? The people we were being discouraging from reproducing were black people. They were poor people. They were illiterate people. We already had in our minds in the early part of the 20th century who we didn't want to be contributing to the gene pool of our population. Positive eugenics was to encourage those people who had the good genes. And guess what? Those people tended to be upper middle class white folk. And those are the ones that we want to have as many kids as possible. This is not just a trivial thing. There were eugenics fairs that went all across America with all kinds of diagrams and charts showing these terrible bad people that were causing so much crime and problems that we had to get rid of it, and all of the ideal families with 20 kids because, you know, all that sort of stuff. The eugenics movement was not fueled by third-rate intellects. The leading geneticists of the time were a part of the eugenics movement. There were eugenics societies. There were annual eugenics fairs and eugenics meetings. There were eugenics journals. You can go to the library and look up the eugenics journals. There were textbooks and courses. And as I say, these were not fly-by-night people. One of the leaders in genetics in the early 1900s was a man named Edward East. He was a full professor at Harvard. He was the president of the Genetic Society of America, and he wrote a book on eugenics, a widely used textbook. And let me just quote one line from the introduction to his textbook. In reality, the Negro is inferior to the white. This is not hypothesis or supposition. It is a crude statement of actual fact. So there you have one of the leading geneticists of the time, and he uses a word like inferior. Where in science does a word like inferior have any meaning? It's a value judgment. It's got nothing to do with science. So here was a leading scientist who confused his own bigotry with scientifically validated fact. And that's the terrible aspect of this. It was through people like East and eugenic societies, there was a tremendous influence on politicians and on business people. In the United States, geneticists pressed for and got restrictions in immigration from certain countries in Europe that were presumed to be occupied by inferior races. So the immigration policies of the United States were based on a eugenics policy. There were a number of states in the U.S. that had anti-miscegenation laws. There were laws prohibiting interracial marriage, and it was based on a genetic rationale. There were many states that had eugenics acts, including a number of provinces in Canada, including British Columbia and Alberta. And up until the 1960s, Alberta applied the eugenics acts to sterilize inmates in mental institutions for reasons that were claimed to be genetic, but for which we didn't have the knowledge to make such claims. And some of you may even know that Ralph Klein had to make some settlements with the victims of the application of eugenics acts in the province of Alberta. So the claims, the grand intoxication with their insights, were not just scientific issues. They had enormous repercussions that influenced many, many people's lives. And in Canada, one of the people that was very heavily influenced was a politician from British Columbia named A.W. Neil. And in 1937, he is quoted in Hansard as saying, and I quote, "To cross an individual of a white race with an individual of the yellow race is to produce, in 9 cases out of 10, a mongrel wastrel with the worst qualities of both races." Well, 9 to 1 isn't quite a 3 to 1 ratio that Mendel talked about, but he had actually put a number on it. 90% of the time, when you have an interracial marriage between white and yellow, you result in a mongrel wastrel. He said in 1941, in February, he told the Prime Minister, "We in British Columbia are firmly convinced, once a Jap, always a Jap." In other words, it doesn't matter whether you're a second or third generation Canadian by birth. If you've got Japanese genes, you're still like the people over there on the other side of the ocean. Those are statements of genetic notions. The application of half-cock genetic ideas being applied to extrapolate to the behavior of human beings. In the United States, when Japanese Americans, 120,000 Japanese Americans, were evacuated after Pearl Harbor, General John DeWitt was put in charge of the evacuation program. And here's what DeWitt said about what he was involved in. "Racial affinities are not severed by migration. The Japanese race is an enemy race. And whilst many second and third generation Japanese born on United States soil, possessed of American citizenship, have become Americanized, the racial strains are undiluted. It therefore follows that along the vital Pacific coast, over 112,000 potential enemies of Japanese extraction are at large today." So that's just a more sophisticated statement of what Neil had said. Once a Jap, always a Jap. In Nazi Germany, some of the leading geneticists supported the laws of the Nazi Party of race purification that ultimately led to the Holocaust. Benno Müller-Hill, one of the leading molecular biologists who worked with Wally Gilbert on the isolation of the lac repressor, wrote an entire book about the complicity of geneticists in Germany with the Nazi Party. And it's worth reading if you're interested in these kinds of issues. The grand claims, what he showed was the infamous doctor of death at Auschwitz, Josef Mengele, was a human geneticist. He had 2 peer-reviewed grants to do his studies on twins in a concentration camp. The grand claims of scientists have enormous reverberations throughout society, and therefore I believe carry enormous responsibilities on the shoulders of those who are making such claims. That responsibility is indicated by the writing of a social scientist I'm a big fan of named Theodore Rozsák, who wrote an essay once in Daedalus about the implications of the novel Frankenstein. And I want to hasten to remind you, Frankenstein was the scientist, the doctor, not the monster. Let's remember that. And here's what Rozsák said. Dr. Faustus, Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Moreau, Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Cyclops, Dr. Caligari, Dr. Strangelove. The scientist who does not face up to the warning in this persistent folklore of mad doctors is himself the worst enemy of science. In these images of our popular culture resides a legitimate public fear of the scientist's stripped-down, depersonalized conception of knowledge. A fear that our scientists, well-intentioned and decent men and women all, will go on being titans who create monsters. So this is the context within which I would like you to consider the following remarks. For the past 40 years, I've been heavily involved in environmental issues, and that was all because of a book published the very year I began my career as a professor in a university, in 1962. I was just poised at Alberta to become a hotshot geneticist, and I was banged right in the head by a woman when Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. And as I read Silent Spring in 1962, her message, which was so powerful, about the unexpected impacts of pesticides, reverberated directly in my chest. It was as if she was talking just to me. And what her message to me was, yeah, you scientists are clever. You can make powerful chemicals like DDT that kill insects. But you forget the lab or a growth chamber is not the real world. You can perform wonderful things in a lab or growth chamber. But in the real world, you can spray to kill insects, and guess what? You affect fish and birds and human beings, because in nature, in the real world, everything is connected to everything else. The problem with this is that the essence of modern biology and medicine, and especially biotechnology, is reductionism. We focus on a part of nature. We isolate that part of nature, whether it's an atom or a molecule or a cell or an organ. We try to bring it in the lab and separate it from everything else. We control everything impinging on that part of nature, and we measure everything within it. And we acquire very profound insights into that part of nature. Now, ever since Isaac Newton's time, we've assumed that the universe is like a giant mechanical entity. He called it a clockwork mechanism. So the assumption was, if you can break down this machine into its springs and cogs and nuts and bolts and understand how the parts work, then you can eventually fit it all back together and reconstruct the whole. And that's what modern biology, biotechnology, and medicine continue to operate on, this paradigm of reductionism. But in focusing on a part of nature, we lose sight of the context within which that part exists. The rhythms, the patterns, the cycles within which that part exists. And I can, you know, I was an arrogant geneticist back in the 1960s. I studied fruit flies, but we didn't give a damn about the whole insect. We used to call them flying bags of chromosomes because we were just interested in studying genes and chromosomes. When I was a brand new assistant professor of genetics, I remember sitting in on a graduate seminar in genetics. And at one point I got up and said, you know, I think the problem with biochemistry today is that biochemists break a cell apart and they look at the parts and make the assumption that if you analyze the ribosomes and the Golgi apparatus and all of the parts within a cell, that eventually they'll be able to create life because they know everything. But I said that I think that the whole cell can simply not be explained on the basis of its isolated parts. Immediately, a grad student, I remember his name vividly, I'm still pissed off at him after all these years, jumped up and said, "You're nothing but a goddamn vitalist." Now, vitalism, for those of you who may not know, vitalism was a very popular idea in the 19th century, that life was distinguished from non-life by possessing a vital force, like a spirit, So scientists used to take a plant or an animal and they'd weigh it and then kill it and then weigh it to see whether you could find out how much weight this vital force has. So it was a whole discredited notion of this idea that life was very, very special because of this vital force. All I was saying was that when you put parts together, they interact and new properties emerge that you can't predict on the basis of its parts. And that's what physicists learned early in the 20th century. That when you study, for example, all of the physical properties of hydrogen, you know everything about atomic hydrogen, and all of the physical properties of oxygen, when you then ask a physicist, on the basis of what you know about atomic hydrogen and atomic oxygen, what is the property of a molecule of two atoms of hydrogen joined to one atom of oxygen, a molecule of water? And you know what the physicist tells you? I'll be damned if I know. Because physicists know there are emergent properties. There are new properties coming from the interaction of the parts that cannot be predicted on the basis of the properties of the isolated parts. But biologists, in part because of the past history with vitalism, biologists still cling to this idea of understanding the whole by separating or focusing on the individual parts. And herein lies, I think, one of the fundamental weaknesses of all of the underpinnings of biotechnology. One of the eminent scientists at Berkeley, who was the chair of the molecular biology department at Berkeley, Richard Stroman, has said, and I quote, "When you insert a single gene into a plant or an animal, the technology will work. You'll get a desired characteristic. But you will also have produced changes in the cell and the organism as a whole that are unpredictable. Genes exist in networks, interactive networks, which have a logic of their own. And the fact that the industry folks don't deal with these networks is what makes their science incomplete and dangerous. We are in a crisis position where we know the weakness of the genetic concept, but we don't know how to incorporate it into a new, more complete understanding." So I've always said for years that the so-called expert that's working in molecular biology that tells you we know enough to be able to anticipate all, all the hazards, that you insert the gene and all of its controlling elements and they should behave the way we want. So we get a designer organism by introducing the proper gene and its controls. But natural selection does not act on each gene independently. As Richard Stroman had said, genes exist within a network. From the moment of fertilization to the production of a mature organism, development and differentiation proceed in an exquisitely orchestrated sequence where the genes and suites of genes are turned on and off in a specific order. The entire genome, all of the genes in the nucleus of that organism, is the unit of selection through the phenotypic expression of those genes as the cascade of reactions takes place over time. When a gene, then, is inserted into an alien genome, if you take the gene out of a flounder that is responsible for the synthesis of an antifreeze molecule, we have really no idea how that gene from a flounder will fit within the genome of a strawberry plant, for example. The gene gets in there, yeah, it's DNA. But it sits there going, where the hell am I? Who are all these other genes here? I've never known them before. As I said, it's like taking Bono out of U2 and sticking him in the Vancouver Symphony and saying, make music. You'll get noise coming out of there, but who knows what the sum total of that effect will be. We simply cannot predict. Well, can enough studies be done to allow us to proceed? I think the areas of ignorance remained and are so vast that it really doesn't make sense to rush to apply these technologies. Like any revolutionary area of science, my experience is every experiment yields results that raise more questions than answers that you have solved.
Right now, our manipulative powers are mind-boggling. No question. They're absolutely impressive. But our basic knowledge of the consequence of those manipulations is too limited. The problem I have is, what is driving the sense of urgency to apply the ideas? Well, the answer, of course, it's not about improving the human condition or the environment around. It's pure and simple money. Money is driving the application of this technology and nothing else. You know, I often hear biotechnologists saying, well, look, we've got an exploding human population. If we don't have biotechnology, there's no way that we're going to be able to feed all of the people that are going to be in the world in another 30 or 40 years. But wait a minute now. Biotechnology is very expensive. Now, the exploding world population, most of that explosion is going on in the poorest countries of the world, where the World Bank tells us 3 billion people now live on $2 or less a day. Wait a minute now. Biotechnology is expensive. The people that are growing in population that are poor, that need the food, are living on less than $2 a day. Something doesn't compute here. Is biotechnology this wonderful activity that we're going to pour billions of dollars into and find new kinds of foods and ways of growing food that we will then give to the people? Because they're the ones that need it. Don't buy the bogus argument. We need genetic engineering to feed the world's burgeoning masses. That's not what it's about. They can't afford it. And yet we're trying to drive biotechnology into African countries that don't want it and using the excuse they need it in order to feed their populations. This is all a total bogus operation. You want me to predict where the really big bucks lie in biotechnology today? If I was a young man going into biotechnology and I was money hungry, you know what I'd do? Find a way to grow hair on bald heads. You're going to make trillions of dollars, believe me. And I don't doubt that that's an area that's going on in genetic engineering now. It's all about money. But I'll tell you something. I am an old geezer. I graduated from the University of Chicago in 1961 with a PhD. But believe it or not, we were pretty smart back. We weren't just stupid because we were so way back then. I mean, we knew about DNA. That very year in December, the first triplet letter was deciphered. You know, UUU codes for phenylalanine. That was very exciting. We knew about codons. We knew about cistrons. We knew about regulator factors of gene activity. And we knew about cell division and differentiation and all of those processes. We knew what the structure of DNA was. But if I was to tell you in this room what our hottest ideas of 1961 were, you would all laugh your heads off. Because of course, 45 years after that, the hottest ideas of 1961 seem absurd. They were so far off the mark. But 20 years from now, the hotshot ideas everybody is setting up biotech companies to exploit will seem every bit as ridiculous. Don't we understand the very essence of science, especially in revolutionary areas, is most of our current ideas are wrong. That's not a denigration of science. It's the very means by which science progresses. You make a set of observations. You have no idea what the hell it means. So what you do is you create a hypothesis to try to make sense of the observations. It doesn't mean the hypothesis is some kind of holy entity. It's just a way of making sense, maybe this works, that allows you to do an experiment and test it. You carry out a test of the hypothesis, you get your results, you look at your results, chances are you go, oh my God, was I ever wrong? Throw out that hypothesis and set up another one. Or you may modify that tremendously before you do another experiment. That's the way science progresses. And that's why our hot ideas of now will move us into a totally different area or understanding 15 or 20 years from now. That's the nature of revolutionary ideas. And so I find it absolutely puzzling then that in the full knowledge that most of our current ideas will prove to be wrong, there is still such a strong desire to get on with getting money and applying those. When Tony Griffiths and I first wrote our textbook, An Introduction to Genetic Analysis, which became the most widely used genetics text in the world, and I'm very proud of that. We wrote it to be timeless. We said we're only going to deal with absolutely rock solid basic concepts in genetics. And so once we write it, you know, it'll last for years and years. Within a year after that first issue came out, we were already being pressured by our publisher to start work on a revision. And since then, the book has been revised at least 7 times. So why is that? You know, what it means is that the field is constantly being expanding, is growing, changing, and we have to keep up with it by modifying the text on basic introductory genetics. So most of our current ideas are going to be very far off the mark. And it becomes very, very dangerous, in my view, to rush to apply these ideas. Okay, so remember that all the claims then about the results of the Human Genome Project, remember how that was going to lead to all of these wonderful cures for diseases and insights into complex hereditary conditions? Well, I mean, anybody that believed that had no idea about how complex life is. The elucidation of the human genome was an unbelievable achievement, a technological achievement that will feed scientists for years into the future, trying to analyze and make sense and interpret the results that were obtained. But what the human genome did instantly was show us that it's just a linear sequence of letters. And it doesn't tell you anything about what happens after that information is transcribed and translated, and you have to deal with an organism that is three-dimensional and moving through the dimension of time. We've got a long way to go to understand these complex conditions. The problem then is our technologies for analysis and manipulation have become very powerful, but we know almost nothing about what the consequences of our manipulations will be. And I'd just like to indicate one concrete example. DDT was synthesized by organic chemists during the 1800s. And it was quite an achievement. It's a very complex ring molecule with lots of chlorine atoms stuck on it. But it wasn't until the 1930s that a scientist named Paul Müller, working for Geigy in Switzerland, discovered that DDT kills insects. We thought, what a wonderful discovery. Geigy knew they'd make a lot of money. They did. Scientists thought this is a great discovery, and he won a Nobel Prize for his discovery in 1948. Now, when DDT began to be used in the 1930s, we knew enough in genetics to say, wait a minute now, you're going to use this chemical to kill insect pests, but when you spray it and kill insects, you're going to select like mad for resistant mutants. So surely, once you start spraying, what remains will be the resistance, and then you're going to have to develop different kinds of... We knew enough to predict that, but geneticists didn't say anything. In the 1930s, ecologists already knew that the most diverse, the most important, the most numerous group of animals in the world are insects. For every human being on Earth, it's estimated there are at least 200 million insects. So long after human beings are extinct, don't worry, there'll be lots of bugs around the world. Now, ecologists knew that insects were crucial parts of ecosystems around the world and could have said, wait a minute now, you want to spray a chemical to kill an insect pest in your garden or your farm that kills all insects. Now, maybe one out of every 1,000 insect species is a pest, but the vast majority of insects are really important parts of the ecosystem. Think of honeybees and fertilization of flowering plants. You know, this idea of using an insecticide that kills all insects just for the one or two species that are pests would be like saying, we've got a crime on the East End of Vancouver. We better kill everybody in the East End. We'll get rid of crime. Well, that's one way to try to manage it. Doesn't strike me as a very smart way to do it. But man, we thought this is great. Geneticists did, ecologists didn't say anything. But by the 1950s, bird watchers began to report there's something funny happening with birds. And that's when Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. And biologists discovered something they didn't even know existed called biomagnification. You spray DDT in parts per tens of millions, DDT is absorbed and sequestered in microorganisms, which are eaten by bigger organisms. And at each trophic level up the food chain, you concentrate it. So by the time you get to the fatty tissue in the shell glands of birds and in the breasts of women, you've concentrated DDT hundreds of thousands of times. So here's a classic example where I don't think there was much basic science thought about the consequences of spraying DDT. But even the best science of that time could not have anticipated the long-term effects of DDT because we didn't even know about biomagnification. Let me state as I end, I have absolutely no doubt that enormous discoveries of enormous importance for humankind are going to be made in the area of genetics and biotechnology. I don't doubt that at all. And I look forward to the time. But as I say, we are so ignorant at this point, it becomes downright dangerous to begin to introduce it into the food stream, into our drugs, and even out in the fields where hundreds of test plots of genetically altered trees are already going today. I think this is absolutely crazy. So I'd like to end my little tirade with Theodore Rozsák. Where did the doctor's great project go wrong? Not in his intentions, which were beneficent, but in the dangerous haste and egotistic myopia with which he pursued his goal. It is both a beautiful and a terrible aspect of our humanity, this capacity to be carried away by an idea. For all the best reasons, Victor Frankenstein wished to create a new and better human type. What he knew was the secret of the creature's physical assemblage. He knew how to manipulate the material parts of nature to achieve an astonishing result. Yet what he did not know was the secret of personality in nature. Yet he raced ahead, eager to play God without knowing God's most divine mystery. And I think that's well worth reflecting on as we think about this area. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We now have about half an hour to entertain some questions. We do have two microphones on the floor here if you'd like to line up. And we also have an audio feed with UBC Okanagan, and we can basically get that on the way. So if you have any questions, please feel free to come up to the mic. And also be aware that right after the Q&A, David will be around for about an hour to sign books in the main foyer.
Before I go to the question here, let me just say, I do not receive money from any biotech companies or government or my environmental organization or other corporations. And I think when we get up, maybe we ought to say where we're coming from.
Hi, Dr. Suzuki. So as you said,
You're a student in what area?
Pardon?
What's your area of study?
I'm in high school.
Aha, yeah. Okay.
So,
good, a virgin mind.
Yeah. So as you said, we're facing this huge problem of not knowing the consequences of our unprecedented power of manipulation. And there's also this great impulse for us to apply those things that we don't really know the consequences to because there's a lot of money to the business. But so what solutions or ways would you suggest that we deal with that problem?
Okay, well, let me say, first of all, we've got to stop using death as if it's the justification for everything that we do. You know, I hear, well, what about the woman with a child is so severely deformed and will die a terrible death if we don't test these drugs immediately? Death, every one of us is going to die. All we can do with science is maybe extend our lives beyond the time when we could. So let's not use death as if somehow we're going to use science and conquer death. We're not going to. And I think we've got to use this as We've got to stop using it as the ultimate catastrophe. When are we ever, you know, this is the thing biotechnologists say to me, well, if what you say is right, when will we ever apply the knowledge? You know, we need to get on with it. Well, my suggestion is when an area is mature enough, then we can advance to the next stage. For example, when you can go in and clip out or synthesize a specific sequence of DNA, and then take it and insert it at exactly the designated place within the genome of the recipient organism, and then predict with absolute certainty what the phenotypic expression of that gene will do during the life of that organism. And when you can do that repeatedly with different organisms, I'd say you're ready to advance to the next step. The problem with that, of course, is when you get to that level, nobody will publish their papers, because that's already known, right? Last time I heard, we're still publishing lots of papers in biotechnology. So I think that we ought to get to a point of very strong control and predictability, and then move to the next stage. Let me tell you what one of the simple ways of genetic engineering in plants is. You load up little microscopic balls with DNA. You attach DNA to these tiny balls, which are like pellets. You put them into a miniature shotgun, and you blast it, because the cell wall of the plant is very rigid. You blast it into the plant and hope that maybe some of those pellets will get far enough in for the DNA to be liberated and you select out the cells that have the expression. That, to me, is not very sophisticated science. And I think we ought to be a hell of a lot more sophisticated before we start making these applications. We're already testing hundreds of plots of genetically engineered trees all over the world, especially in China. Now, you know, we've had this unbelievable case in Canada where a farmer in Saskatchewan has had genetically engineered seeds or pollen flow into his field. Somehow, Monsanto's canola got onto his field. Not only did he have to pay Monsanto to clean up what he did not want in the first place, because he was not found guilty of stealing it, he's going to have to pay them in the future for any acreage that's contaminated. And he is guilty, or he has to pay them for any Roundup Ready canola found on his property. In other words, doesn't matter how Monsanto's plants got there, whether they're taken by wind or water or birds, once it's on your property, they still own it and you got to pay for it. All right, we're going to grow genetically engineered trees. What if some of those plots are next to a national park like Banff? We know that pollen will move for miles and miles. When they start fertilizing the trees in our parks, are they going to be Monsanto's trees? Are we then, you know, who? I mean, there are enormous implications of this. And I think it's just nuts to be carrying out these massive experiments. So I think that it's far too premature. There are too many questions that are being asked. And the driving pressure is money, but it's the genetics community that it does not want to face up to even considering these questions. This is a university. It ought to be a ferment of this kind of discussion. You don't see that. Because molecular biologists have bought into it. They're no different to me from scientists who used to work with the nuclear industry or the tobacco industry. They've got a vested interest. So one thing I would ask you as you listen to the pronouncements of our experts about the wonderful benefits of biotechnology, ask them one question: where do you get your money? Because I think that's a very important consideration.
Hello, I'm a university student here. I'm studying computer science and psychology. What I'm asking, could you comment on the idea that as I think about our growth of knowledge and the research that we're doing, what about guided research, where we have biotechnology companies that are getting lots of money from investors who are then going and producing science that benefits only them? I was wondering, could you comment on just your thoughts about that in terms of where knowledge in general might be going?
Well, I mean, it's a very good question. You know, when I was growing up as a scientist, we took pride in the fact that our research was in basic biology. We looked down our noses at medical geneticists because we said, oh, they're just applied, you know, they're just plumbers. They're not real scientists who are searching to increase the body of knowledge that we can all participate in. And because we are basic scientists, we had a responsibility for how that body of knowledge is applied. Once we had private companies being welcomed into the university, it fouled the atmosphere. This is one of the terrible aspects of this university. I remember when David Strangway came in as a president, you know, and he had a very practical, he was a geologist, and he had a very practical thing. And one of the first documents he wrote was that the university is the economic engine of society. And I was a columnist for the Globe and Mail then, and I wrote an article saying, that may be what David Strangway thinks, but I'll tell you, a hell of a lot of academics would argue violently with that idea. Well, Strangway never forgave me for that, but I had tenure, so I didn't worry. But what I've seen is the continuation of that whole model. Go to the forestry faculty and look in the main building and look at all the signs in the forestry faculty from all of the forest companies that are funding the scientists there. And then ask, why is it that UBC's forestry faculty was one of the biggest enemies of people like me that were fighting against the unsustainable practices of clear-cut logging? You know, once money starts going into the university, and the university should be the one place, because we have tenure, because we are supported by the public. This should be the place where you have a ferment of activities where you should be free to discuss them. Once you had biotech companies being welcomed into the university because it was a source of potential revenue, you began to lock up people. They were no longer free to talk because that idea might get out to a competitor. So what happened is the university became the opposite of what it should be, a community of scholars sharing information and dreaming and questioning and asking questions. And I think that now reflects on the scientists that are going up, setting up biotech companies. They don't give a shit whether that money, knowledge is going to be of benefit to you. Their priority is to make sure they've got a marketable product that will give them, increase their money. Universities were places that were supposed to be the place to say, wait a minute now, you know, there are other considerations. But we've gone a long way down the wrong road since then. Kelowna.
Can you hear me clearly, Dr. Suzuki?
Yes.
This disembodied voice belongs to a chemistry professor up here at Kelowna. A few weeks ago, Dr. Orr was here. He presented to us a list of crises that face our society, crises that we need to overcome in the next century if our civilization is to have a reasonable chance of survival. He spoke during a federal election campaign. It goes without saying none of those crises were part of the political debate. The politicians who are in perhaps the best position to initiate and cause real social change don't realize that these are even issues we should be talking about. So my question for you, and I'll direct it also by proxy to every undergraduate who's sitting there listening to this disembodied voice, but I'm only going to ask you to answer it. When are you going to run for political office?
I have been courted by all three parties, actually, over the last 30 years, and I just know I'd be a lousy politician, and if I did run, I wouldn't be able to run for any of the major parties. So if I were elected, I'd just sit there as an independent of one. And I think that having had the nature of things and a public broadcast outlet, from my standpoint, I've been able to share and spread ideas far beyond anything I could have ever done as a single sitting member of Parliament, either at the BC level or at the federal level. When Glenn Clark resigned and Ujjal Dosanjh took over, Ujjal was really desperate at that time, and he decided to try to get a couple of people in that would add visibility, and he got Ed John to come in, who's a leader of the First Nations, and he called me one night. I was in Toronto, and he said, look, would you consider being a minister? I'd appoint you immediately to cabinet here in BC. I hung up so fast, I said no and hung up so fast that it was only when the phone went down, I thought, oh, which ministry was he offering me? And, you know, I knew that if he had had 2 years or more, it might have been an opportunity to just get in and raise holy shit. But anyway, that's the only time I thought, maybe there was a chance. I think the terrible thing that's happened in this country is that there is no question that some of the leading issues that confront us, like the future of sustainable communities and a sustainable environment, are ecological. They're environmental issues. And certainly if you poll people the right way, the public says overwhelmingly, over 95% of Canadians will say, nature is important to me as a Canadian. Over 90% will say, yes, I'm willing to have my taxes increased to protect nature. And yet, when you look at the issues that were raised during the last campaign, the environment was completely out of it. First of all, the media are unbelievably lazy and unresponsive to these issues. We've just done a poll that shows that in the media, the environment isn't even considered an important issue for the kinds of reporting they're doing. They're very lazy, and because in this case, they've refused to put the Greens on the agenda for the debates, they act as if, oh, well, if we don't have a Green leader here, then we can forget the environment, and we don't have to quiz the leaders on their environmental policy. But there's a deeper, more fundamental problem. If you're a politician, you must, of necessity, when elected, worry as soon as you're in office about the next election. And you can bet that ever since he's been in office, Harper's main priority is what do we do to get reelected. So in terms of something like climate change or the vanishing fish in the oceans or deforestation, these are such long-term projects. No politician can afford to focus on those issues. Future generations do not vote. Children don't even vote. Fish or birds or trees don't vote. So a politician has a very, very restricted priority in terms of his or her constituency. They're only concerned with people that are going to vote in the next election. So the political process, aside from this first-past-the-post idea that we've bought into, the political process is fundamentally flawed. You don't get any points for doing the right thing if the payoff for doing the right thing is 15 or 20 years down the road.
Hello. Hello. Hi, my name's Justin Davis, and I'm a graduate student in the graduate program in neuroscience here. But before I did this, I did agricultural research, and I did pre-registration trials for various agrochemicals and transgenic seed products. And these trials were sponsored by Monsanto's, BASF's, Syngenta's, Pioneer Hybrid. And my question is, what do you say to the family farmer? Because family farming is the hardest business there is in Canada. It's the only business where you buy at retail and sell it wholesale. And you're given a product where you're told, okay, if you use these seeds, you're going to produce this much of a higher yield, use this many fewer chemicals, and be able to make this much more money. And you have a bank lien hanging over your head, you have three kids you have to feed, and you talk about money being the driving force behind the creation of these products. Well, it's also the demand from the user of these products being the Canadian family farmer. What do you say to him? Do you say, don't use these products in spite of the fact you need them for your family?
The fundamental, this of course is always the argument given by the industry.
This is the one, this was
what
the
they're
one
saying is, look, we're being ecologically responsible because what you've got is a plant that tolerates or is resistant to glyphosate, the exactly. ingredient of Roundup. So once it's Roundup resistant, then you only have to spray a few times and you eliminate the competitors. You don't have to spray constantly. But what it means is you're locked into a very complex situation where the people who sell the seeds are also the people that are marketing the chemical that those seeds depend on. And now we're even trying, and Canada as a country is pushing the idea of Terminator technology, which means that those seeds cannot be saved from generation to generation. They're going to be sterile, and you're going to have to go back to the seed company to buy those seeds that are dependent on its chemicals. So it's a really iniquitous kind of system that's being designed for the benefit of the big companies. First of all, okay. I would say the problem we have today is people are not paying as much for food as they should, because all of the ecological and social consequences of industrial agriculture or the so-called Green Revolution, you buy into a huge technology of big, you know, heavy use of machinery and chemicals, that delivers very few of the dollars to the farmer. The farmer is getting screwed
totally.
Because the product that comes out delivers such, you know, one penny out of every 10 cents goes to the farmer. All of the money really goes on the other end. And it's just like the author, I just found this out, I wrote books for a Canadian company that went belly up. And in the feeding chain, the author who writes the books is the lowest priority that gets only 10 cents of every dollar that is actually earned by that book. So we didn't count. We didn't get any of the money back. So the farmer is caught in this situation where they're not getting an amount that they're needed, and they're being kept out of the where I think the growth area, and the only way to go is organic, is to go back to traditional ways, because they bought into a mindset that industrial agriculture is modern agriculture and going to organic is going backwards. There's a tremendous amount of brainwashing, and the terrible thing we did 15 years ago, we did a program on organic farming. And I thought, this is a slam dunk. Everybody's going to love this show because it was obvious this is the way to go. We got hammered, not by farmers. We got hammered by the University of Guelph and the University of Saskatchewan, where their professors have all bought in to the modern industrial farming is the only way to go. And what we were promulgating was regarded as a backward move. And that's exactly the message that you're promulgating,
this was the one that was fed to me so that I would actually
do the
work.
But that's what the biotech companies do. And it's a very effective one.
Yeah.
It's a very effective one. But if we want long-term, you know, look at what's happening now with Roundup Ready wheat. Mm-hmm. The farmers know that if they buy into genetically engineered wheat, 80% of their market in Europe and Japan will disappear. And our government has been trying to peddle genetically modified wheat in Canada. And so far, the farmers have kept it out. And the other thing, of course, is if you're already an organic farmer and Monsanto's genetically engineered plants get onto your field, you're screwed.
Well, they do, because like participating in these trials, it was Liberty Link corn that we were working for before that seed became registered for mass sale. We just tested it out, and then we send it to the lab for testing. Well, the way we would grow the corn is, the only restriction we had from CFIA was to grow border corn, 12 rows of it, and make sure that there was no corn within 200 meters of our test plots. Well, you can't really account for birds, bees, and wind coming and pollinating. So it's out there already, untested.
Like, no, it's an unbelievably cynical approach by business, especially when it's been shown categorically that you do get carriage of pollen over very large distances.
Yes.
So the idea of having a fringe to just isolate a field is absurd in the real world. So, and if you look at television, you know, the biotech companies, which are now huge, have a huge budget to afford very fancy television ads, and they're very effective.
But these companies are the same ones that are making household chemicals that you use to wipe down your sink, put in your shampoo, whatever. So if you buy an organic vegetable and you bring it into an environment where these chemicals are still made, that's why the whole organic movement.
You're absolutely right. It's interesting. I was up in Kamloops 2 weekends ago with the oncologists of British Columbia. These are the cancer experts. And, you know, cancer rates are skyrocketing now, and the budgets, of course, are skyrocketing because so much depends on chemicals. And when I said, we're the planet now in any city or area, we'll have between 50 and 70,000 chemicals in various concentrations in our environment. There's no way we can isolate 2, 3, or 4 compounds, which by themselves are perfectly harmless, but that interact in some synergistic way and produce a problem. If you poison the earth, what do we think is going to happen to us? Why do we have epidemic levels of asthma, of breast cancer? I mean, just go down the line. This is not genetic. These are environmental. These scientists had never really thought about the bigger picture. It was shocking to me. So we've got to start looking at the bigger picture, I think.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Winnie Knoll, and I'm a very upset consumer and a member of society, and it led right into what I was up here for, is that March the 20th to 31st in Brazil, and I've come as a citizen. Somebody gave me a ticket yesterday to this. Our government is pushing to overturn the ban on these Terminator seeds that Dr. Suzuki was talking about. And it's absolutely diabolical that the farmers all over the world in India years ago, many of them have committed suicide. Thousands of farmers in India have committed suicide over this whole area of Terminator seeds that have a life of 1 year. From time immemorial, farmers have done seed saving and seed sharing. And our government, with New Zealand and the US and Australia, are going to go to Brazil at the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, and they are going to push to overturn the ban on Terminator seeds. And there is nothing in the media, there was nothing in the election campaign. Thank God for people like Dr. Suzuki, but I urge you all to get onto your MP immediately you leave here.
There's no special testing going on. But not only do we think that this is substantially equivalent to regular organisms, we think this is an unbelievable opportunity. So our government is actually cheerleading the biotech companies and leading the charge on what I consider a technology of death, which is a fundamental break with the tradition that has impelled humankind for the past 10,000 years, that farmers save their seed from year to year, and that seed is exquisitely adapted to the specific conditions of that farmer's fields. That's been the tradition. It's maintained tremendous diversity around the world. Now we're trying to monoculture the planet with an ideology, a mindset, that we're in control, that soil is simply a matrix to hold the plants up, basically. We'll add everything that the plants need to grow, the water and whatever nutrients, will control all the pests by chemicals, and then we'll get a uniform product. That's not how the world exists. It's a very, very destructive kind of technology. And now we're going to end 10,000 years of human activity and technology of selecting and saving seeds from generation to generation. I am absolutely ashamed as a Canadian that this is going on, being promulgated by our own government.
And not a word in the media or anything.
The media are lazy. That doesn't surprise me. They're very lazy. Yes. And most of them now are controlled by big corporations. So there's already a mindset. Do you think the National Post doesn't have an agenda? Anybody that reads the National Post isn't interested in real news. I mean, that's an ideology. And Kelowna?
Hello, Dr. Suzuki. I'm from UBC Okanagan in beautiful Kelowna. My name is Jade Bethune. I'm a biologist and chemistry student, and I would like to ask you a question. First, I'd just like to comment on the struggling farmer statement. I come from a farming family, and to the despair of all farmers reminds me of the old saying that goes, the ecologist tells the working family that for a dollar a day, you can feed a family in Africa all the foods that they need. What do you think of that? Which the working family responds, well, that means I'm paying too much for groceries, obviously.
Yeah. I've never heard that said, but I think that's absurd.
So do I. But first, I would like to say that I respect you a lot for the role that you have taken as the paresiastis of science. And though I would like to be honored to appear in a later speech of yours, I hope it will be because of a good question and not from one that pissed you off. My question is about science for science sake versus the economic model. Is this a model that's going to lead to a doomsday end, or is it possible to redirect the economic model to make profit by saving the environment? If not, what needs to be changed, and what role do the universities have to take to return back to science for science sake?
Well, that's a double-barreled question as far as I'm concerned. First of all, the university, I think the university has no business being in business. I think if an academic has an idea that... if an academic has an idea that can ultimately be patented, that has been supported by the university and by usually government, they ought to be able to set up a company and benefit and give some of the revenues back to the university. That's all fine, but they ought not to be on campus anymore. They ought to be off campus, and they ought to be out in the real world and doing their thing. The university, to me, is a very special community. It's a community of scholars and dreamers who share ideas, who think about society in a broader way, who act as canaries of problems coming up. It's not an accident that in most countries of the world, profound revolutions have started in universities. And that's why a lot of people, ever since I've been at UBC, have wanted to get rid of troublemakers like me. They don't like to hear these ideas, but society in its wisdom has conferred tenure that has allowed me to speak out. Unfortunately, too many people regard tenure as just a job guarantee and you sit on your ass for the rest of your life. That's not what tenure is, as far as I'm concerned. In terms of the drive to apply science, I can tell you, the idea, you know, ever since the La Montagne Commission in the 1970s, we've had this notion of mission-oriented research, where we support research because it's going to pay off. It fails to understand the nature of science. Science doesn't proceed from A to B to C to D to a cure for cancer. That's how we write up our grant proposals. That's a big swizz. We all play the game, right? I studied fruit flies, but I can tell you I wrote elegant grant applications showing if you support me, we're going to solve cancer. We all play the game. But the nature of science is you don't know from experiment one. When you do the experiment, you don't know what the answer is going to be. If you knew that, you don't do the experiment. So how can anyone possibly say, I'm going to do this experiment, then go from here and solve cancer? Chances are good scientists, they end up going, you know, along here, and this other scientist goes along here, and they're going, fine, you know, science. And one day they come together in a bar, and they're sitting there drinking and saying, oh, what do you do? And they go, oh, my God, that's right. I can make a rectal thermometer by using your, and that's how you do it. It's not by consciously saying, I'm going to set up an institute that's going to solve cancer or solve tuberculosis. I mean, that's absurd. What you do is you set up an institution, you hire the best people possible, and you give them as much freedom to explore where those good minds go. And sure enough, if you've got good people, you're going to have a front row seat at the action to what good people around the world are doing, because they're going to get phone calls, they're going to go to private meetings, they're going to hear stuff you don't normally get, and they're the ones that are going to come up with these ideas. So we're doing it all wrong anyway, if we want to really apply science the right way. Do I have time for one more question?
How about one last question?
Hi, Dr. Suzuki. This is Dr. Harold Gu from Taiwan. I want to get a ghost. I am a liver transplant surgeon, and now I shift to the stem cell therapy, it's a regenerative medicine we call it. And I do struggle with these kinds of ethical issues. I face a lot of tons of these kinds of issues, but I'm eager to hear about your point of view, because I really miss myself. In my work. So could you give me some input about how to keep experience science on the righteous trials?
The problem is there's too much pressure from everyone that you, if you're going to go into stem cell research, that you get a payoff. Yeah. People want to be able to grow a liver in vitro, and it would be wonderful. I mean, it'd be great. You've got no problem with rejection. It's your own genotype. Everything's fine. The problem is that kind of pressure leads to far too rapid an attempt, an application. I mean, just look at the history of genetic engineering. Kids were being injected with pieces of DNA as experiments, even though we knew from very early experiments it was killing them. All kinds of people have died from the injection of DNA, and I don't think that was necessary. And I think that we've got to somehow get off this relentless pressure to have an application. I mean, you know, you only have to look at someone like the guy in Korea to see the enormous pressure on that man to get results, and it leads to all kinds of terrible things. We've got to say we need more basic knowledge. We don't know enough yet. So that's all I can say. Be humble.
Oh, yeah, sure.
We've got to be much more humble.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you very much.